Look at the number of people. Okay, for Mr. Pruitt as appellant, we have Mr. Charles Kotubi. Is that pronounced correctly?
Yes, it is.
Thank you. Hearing pro bono, which we appreciate. And for appellees, we have Peter Erdland. Thank you. So please proceed.
May it please the Court, my name is Charles Kotubi, Jr. I'm pro bono counsel for plaintiff appellant Rex Allen Pruitt in this matter. I'd like to reserve 1 minute for rebuttal, please. I'd like to start off by taking no more than a minute and a half of this Court's time to go through the order of proof in a 1983 action alleging a violation of an Eighth Amendment right. A court evaluating a claim must first take the plaintiff's allegations as true and determine whether he has alleged the violation of an actual constitutional right.
Well, has he in this case?
Pardon me, Your Honor?
Has he in this case? Why don't you take it step by step?
I will. With the fact, Your Honor, the court in this case below, kicked out the granted summary judgment at this stage of the process, holding that plaintiff had not alleged the violation of an actual constitutional right in this instance. In situations such as this, an Eighth Amendment claim where the subjective component is integral to the constitutional violation, the Supreme Court in Crawford L. was clear that the plaintiff need not plead clear and convincing evidence at the pleading stage, but must nonetheless put forth specific facts and affirmative evidence to show that a reasonable jury could hold that he has carried his burden as to proving the pertinent motive. That pertinent motive here is subjective recklessness. If the defendant's officials plead qualified immunity, the court must then proceed to determine whether that right was so clearly established that it would be clear to a reasonable officer in a situation that the conduct he engaged in was against the law. This determination is necessarily fact-specific. As this Court held in Estate of Ford not too long ago, that to carry the burden of showing qualified immunity, a burden which the defendant officials hold here, they must show that a reasonable officer would not have known of the plaintiff's particular circumstance or would not have appreciated the harm that would result from ignoring that particular circumstance. If immunity is denied, defendants can still win on summary judgment by showing affirmative evidence, specific facts, that refute the plaintiff's claim as to the state of mind. At that point, if the court has two reasonable inferences on this point, it must accept that most favorable to the non-moving party, plaintiff here. Defendants may win on summary judgment at that stage only if their conduct was objectively reasonable based on undisputed facts or so one-sided that they must prevail as a matter of law. As I said before, the court below said that plaintiff here had not alleged a constitutional violation. However, this case presents a classic example of an Eighth Amendment violation for the denial of medical treatment to a prisoner, a violation that has been well established in this Court and the Supreme Court for nearly three decades. As this Court is well aware, the Eighth Amendment requires an objective and subjective component.
For the denial in this case, I guess, consists primarily of the failure to give the pills through the night.
Correct. That is the
– To a lesser degree, with taking away the pillows – and the equipment,
the physical therapy devices. The primary
constitution. How does this tie into the cases? How do these facts tie into the cases to establish a violation of constitutional right?
The primary constitutional violation here, you're correct, Judge Schwarzer, is the denial of the medication through the night. The doctor in this case prescribed medication every 4 hours around the clock. He got the medication.
What's the best case you have on the problem?
The best case we definitely have is this Court's decision in Hamilton. It was a 1993 case. In that case, in Hamilton, the prison inmate underwent ear surgery, and his treating physician ordered him not to fly for at least 6 months. 1 month later, the defendant officials got the opinion of a prison doctor who cleared him for flight. They put him on a flight. 1 month after surgery, he suffered severe pain. This Court held that the plaintiff there had a serious medical need after ear surgery and that the defendants were deliberately indifferent or reckless to that need. Those facts apply here as well. Here, the plaintiff had a serious medical need after a gunshot wound to the shoulder and two surgeries on his shoulder, his hand, and his hip. the plaintiff's physician prescribed medication around the clock every 4 hours, as well as certain devices such as elevation pillows, bed pads for his comfort, and physical therapy devices to alleviate his pain and speed his recovery. Defendants knew of this pain, knew of the prescriptions, yet deliberately ignored both. Similar to this court's decision in Hamilton. I think Hamilton is the most on point here. Taking first the objective component of the Eighth Amendment, the plaintiff must allege that he has a serious medical need. This court in McGuckin v. Smith was very clear that if the plaintiff has an injury of which a physician has prescribed treatment, that is a concrete indication that he has satisfied the objective test of the Eighth Amendment. Moving on to the subjective component, the Supreme Court in Farmer v. Brennan was very clear that deliberate indifference under Estelle is nothing more than subjective recklessness. That standard will be met if the defendant officials know of an injury. Yes?
In this instance, it's your position that there are no circumstances under which the way the prison officials' refusal to give nighttime medication could be constitutionally valid, or that they simply haven't given any reasons for doing this?
My position would be that is correct as to the first prong of the analysis, that on the complaint as it's pled, we have a constitutional violation here. I think your question goes to the second element more specifically, is whether their action was objectively reasonable. They have posited.
Not solely, no. I think it goes to the constitutionality theory as well. In other words, I'm asking you, suppose they put on a defense, which I don't see, or an explanation which doesn't seem to exist on the current record at this point, to the effect that we have a terribly violent group of people here, and we need to have one guard, in charge of each of them, and there's no way we can have somebody leave to get the medication. And of course, if this was life-threatening medication, we would get it. But if it was simply a matter more or less pain, it's just something given the terrible circumstances in this prison, we absolutely can't do. I mean, I'm not sure what those circumstances would be. But if they had an explanation related to their penal interest that was supervening, is there no way that this would be constitutional?
I think that is correct. I think the Eighth Amendment has been the cases under the Eighth Amendment are very clear here that the failure to follow a doctor's prescription will allege a constitutional violation on the facts as they are put.
But at any rate, here we don't have anything but a very vague.
We have a very vague. They put forth that they were at all times following jail policy in this case, and I see that as going to the argument that they were acting objectively reasonable in this situation by relying on this jail policy. However, the most significant point here is if we find that they were acting reasonably by dispensing medication 4 times a day under the jail policy, we must also find that they were acting unreasonably by failing to follow a similar provision to that same policy, which required medication to be dispensed and the prescribed dosage at the prescribed time.
Is there a point in the litigation where the matter of the penal interest that justified which the defendants sought to justify their actions, when does that come into play?
That will come into play at the second stage, whether their conduct was objectively reasonable under the circumstances.
So you're saying it comes into play in the consideration of whether there's qualified immunity?
Exactly, Your Honor. It comes into play on whether there was qualified immunity at this point, and it could come into play at the end, at the fourth stage of the analysis, at summary judgment as well.
So even if the defendant says, well, it may be true that we took the medication away from him because we didn't like him and we didn't want to coddle him, but we have rules to justify it. So as long as they have the rules, does that remove the element of deliberate indifference?
As long as they have, not in this case, no, Your Honor, because there was contravening rules which said they had to give the prescribed dosage at the prescribed time. And there's nothing in the policy to say which one controls. So we have a vague and ambiguous policy.
Well, it's a policy that would be an invalid policy, a reason for finding qualified immunity anyway? I mean, if you have a policy, but it's would be an invalid policy, and anybody would know it's an invalid policy.
Correct.
Is a this is a substantial question. I mean, is a subordinate official, say somebody who isn't running the jail but is a lesser official, entitled to rely on the policy even if it's an invalid policy or for qualified immunity purposes or not?
I don't think it's entitled to rely on a policy like that. A jail policy cannot control the definition of cruel and unusual punishment under the Eighth Amendment, lest we run into a slippery slope where obedient prison officials are routinely torturing plaintiffs and relying on jail policy to justify their actions.
Well, the jail policy would still come into play once the case goes to trial and the jury to determine whether it's deliberate.
Absolutely. And that's
the point I was trying to get.
Yeah, absolutely. It would definitely come in at the fourth stage of the analysis, and the plaintiff would be entitled to get to trial at this stage. Plaintiff would be entitled to get to trial at this stage because I don't believe that this ambiguous jail policy is enough to say that no reasonable jury could find for the plaintiff in this case. Yeah, I see that my time is up. I'll turn the podium over to my colleague and reserve anything else for a rebuttal.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Katubi. Mr. Erblin, welcome to Seattle.
Thank you very much. Members of the court and counsel, I represent the officers of Bonner County who are the defendants in this case. They are entitled to qualified immunity on these facts. We agree that as a broad proposition that somebody's Eighth Amendment rights should not be violated, their right to be free from cruel and unusual punishment. But the Supreme Court and this circuit recognize that an analysis of qualified immunity overlaying atop of a constitutional right must be made in a specific factual context.
There's a lot of case law, a surprising amount actually, that suggests that not giving medication, when you know what the person's medical problem is and when you have the doctor who's prescribed a remedy for it, and if you don't follow it, that is likely to be a constitutional violation. So what's reasonable about not giving the person the medication in the middle of the night?
In response to that question, and that's exactly the point I was going to make, is that the outright denial of medication, as Judge Schwartzer says, what's your most closely analogous case? The outright denial of medication may be proof of deliberate indifference, but that isn't what happened here. Here we have the administration of medication four times a day. And factually specific analysis shows that from January 31 to February 9th, which is 9 days, Mr. Pruitt was administered this pain medication four times a day. Now, if they had followed the prescription as argued by counsel, which would be every 4 hours as needed. It doesn't say around the clock. It says every 4 hours as needed. That means six times.
I thought there was one point at which the doctor, to clarify, said around the clock.
That would be Dr. Russ. But the original, from January to February, Dr. Russ did not.
Fine. But eventually he did, and he still didn't do it.
He did. And that eventually, that was April 4th to May 1. That's 26 days where Mr. Pruitt was administered medication four times a day as opposed to six. So that's not an outright denial of medication.
You had a doctor saying that he needed it all the time, and you had him saying that he was in bad pain as a result of not getting it. And I don't see the difference. I mean, why is it okay if one-third of the time is in terrible pain and against the specific directions of the doctor?
Well, and I think that in hindsight, certainly I, as an advocate, would rather they had administered it every 4 hours. They did not. The question is whether or not that's a constitutional violation. But I agree with you, Judge Berzon, that perhaps if a doctor says every 4 hours as needed, then you should get up in the middle of the night or have somebody there in the middle of the night that administers medication. Did not occur here. The jail policy administers medication. It's 7, 12, 5, and 9, and does not administer medication.
So is your argument that it was constitutional to do that, or is your argument that I can see three possible arguments. One, it was constitutional to do that, because it was only a third of the time. The second is that it was not constitutional, but that it was reasonable to think it was for some reason. Or third, that the subordinate officers didn't have to worry about whether it was constitutional or not, because it was jail policy, and all they had to do was follow the jail policy.
The court below found that there was no constitutional violation. We agree that there was. However, following your second point, Judge Berzon, the question on qualified immunity is whether or not the officer, it was patently violative of a constitutional right, or whether there was a clearly established constitutional right of which a reasonable officer would have known. And it's our position that the officer would not have known that it was constitutionally necessary to administer medication at 4 o'clock in the morning, that gap between 9 and 7.
Well, didn't the officer know that it had been prescribed by the doctor? Isn't that enough?
Yes, Judge, the officer did.
So he knew that, and he knew so that he could know there was a serious medical need.
He knew that there was a medical need for this patient, for this prisoner, yes.
And then there are some other facts in this case that are alleged by way of affidavit that suggest that there was a deliberate effort to withhold medication and other...
I see those affidavits are in the record.
So doesn't that raise the question as to whether the officers were acting in a fashion that they had reason to think was not consistent with the Constitution?
If we accept the affidavits as true...
Well, for purposes of the motion, they may be impeached at trial, and all
right.
of this will go to whether there's a violation, in fact, at the trial. But for purposes of qualified immunity, we have to accept those affidavits.
I think we do, but I don't believe, Judge Forster, that the intent on the part of the officer to withhold medication to inflict pain has an effect on the qualified immunity defense, because
doesn't that bear on whether it's objectively reasonable to withhold the medication?
If it was objectively reasonable to withhold the medication, that has to do with his subjective intent. I think the question is whether or not there is a closely analogous case that would allow an officer to withhold medication after having administered it four times a day as opposed to six.
Also, you say there has to be a case that with the specific facts before you can hold the officer.
I do not, but I want to point out that the cases cited by counsel are the outright denial or withholding of medical treatment or medication, which did not occur in this case.
Well, Estelle itself said that it was unconstitutional, deliberate indifference if to intentionally interfere with treatment once prescribed. They did that here. In other words, there's no qualification in the cases that said it's okay if you do it, you know, one-third of the time but not the other two-thirds of the time. Do the cases have the qualification that you're suggesting?
The only cases that I've been able to find, and I believe the cases also cited by counsel, are the outright withholding of medication. And counsel cited some of those in his brief.
But that, of course, is a question of how you look at it. They were outright withholding the medication for 8 hours a day. So it's just a question of what cut you take at the facts.
You certainly could, Your Honor, and I agree, because the policy is to prescribe medication, deliver medication at 7 o'clock and also at 12. There's 5 hours. So arguably, if we view this in its most technical sense, there is a one-hour violation right there. The question is whether or not that arises to a constitutional violation, whether it shows a deliberate
indifference. The question is why anybody reading the case law that was extant at the time would not think it was – when the statements are general and there is no qualification in the statements, as I understand it, that says that it matters if it's only happened some of the time – would think that there's such a qualification. Why would they think that?
I didn't.
Why would, in reading the cases extant in 1999, would a reasonable officer think that withholding medication on direct doctor's orders is okay as long as it doesn't happen all the time? Where would he get that from?
Well, simply because my response is that there is no directly analogous case that refers to providing medication four times a day as opposed to six times a day. And this is pain medication. Not that I take any delight or anyone takes any delight in somebody else's pain, Your Honor, but this is not a life-threatening situation or an emergency or a situation where if you don't administer the medication, such as in the cases cited by counsel, there's going to be an increase of his medical condition.
In that regard, could you briefly address the physical therapy equipment? Because there is an allegation that there was a serious impediment to his recovery, and which necessitated surgery and so on. I understand that there is some general assertion that there was a security problem, but I guess I don't know what this equipment is, so I'm having a hard time understanding what the security problem is.
There actually is an affidavit of Officer Day, who was in charge of the jail at the time, in which, and it's in the record, and in which he asserts that he was concerned with safety of the other inmates and also of other officers if these pulleys and therabands were made available to
What are they? Are they? I mean, I don't know if it says in the record, what are they? Therabands sounds like something soft. Is that not right?
Well, the record doesn't show. I mean, I know personally what they are. We can talk about that. But the pulleys obviously are a device that have a cord on them that are available that somebody could use, I imagine, in some sort of a sense of a weapon. Of course, we know that some of the most benign
articles that he uses weapons. He had a nurse. He had somebody who was willing. He was paying a nurse, as it was. He was willing to have this nurse supervise it. He was willing to have him do it in some other location. He was using them anyway in the hospital. So if he was going to hurt somebody, he could hurt somebody there. So I'm wondering whether, at least as a summary judgment matter, the fair statement that there was a security problem is sufficient.
Well,
because here, as to this, there were very specific allegations that there was an interference with his recovery and so on.
In that sense, there was an affidavit or there's a report, but it's not an affidavit and it's unverified from a physical therapist that the inability to use the therabands and the pulleys was delaying the increase in the range of the motion that the doctor was looking for.
Resulting in surgery.
True, but there's no verified medical evidence that this delay in using these pulleys increased the likelihood of him having this capsulitis, which the doctor had to treat him for in any event, because that's where the wound had occurred. I see that I'm out of time, and there is one last question I did not answer. I'd be glad to answer if I could.
Go ahead. You may answer.
And that is the question on jail policy, and I think that was the third prong of Judge Berzon's question, whether or not adherence to a jail policy, if it's patently, if it is reasonable on its face, allows an officer to claim qualified immunity. And I'd simply like to quickly point out that Bonner County itself has not been sued as a defendant in this case on Monell liability. And so that analysis is not available to us, and that claim is not available to Mr. Pruitt. Arguably, if the policy itself was unconstitutional, and yet the officer followed it, because that was his policy, then the officer is entitled to qualified immunity. The entity itself might not escape Monell liability as an unconstitutional policy or procedure, but that's not in this case. Thank you very much.
Very good. Thank you, sir. All right. Mr. Gattubi, we were probably over time, but we said we'd give you a minute or two for rebuttal.
1 minute would be fine, Your Honor. I would like to pick up on one very important point here. We can't forget that, yes, this was just pain medication. But in pain medication, it's very different from something like antibiotics or something like that. With pain medication, a delay in receiving it is, in effect, a denial in receiving it. Pain medication doesn't help a long-term recovery. It's meant to apply only for a four-hour period. There, a delay of 10 hours is, in effect, an outright denial of that medication.
How do you answer the last argument that was made by Mr. Erblin for his clients that even if the policy is wrong, the limited to four times a day, that the correction officials who followed the policy should have immunity?
We have to look at this in a specific paradigm provided by Saucier. Saucier limited this inquiry to whether it was reasonable, for objectively reasonable, for an officer to rely upon it. However, the policy is inherently incoherent. It says you have to adhere to doctor's orders. At the same time, you have to follow this policy. That does not give an officer an objectively reasonable basis to rely upon it in actually violating the Eighth Amendment in this case. Judge Berzon, you were absolutely right. The case law nationwide here is overwhelming in favor of plaintiff. The denial of medication is an Eighth Amendment violation. The failure to properly treat pain when it can be easily alleviated and is known to defendants is tantamount to the willful infliction of pain, indeed the core concern of the Eighth Amendment. I'd like to end there unless the panel has any other questions.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Pruitt v. Roos et al. Shall be submitted. Thank counsel for their fine argument. We also thank each of you for traveling to Seattle for the argument. We will now recess for 15 minutes.